Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest this week is a Grammy-winning production and immersive mixing team of Matt Wallace and Will Kennedy. Matt and Will have done immersive mixes for the Dave Matthews Band, Foreigner, the B-52s, Kid Rock, Selena Gomez, and many more. Matt's work as a producer includes hits for Maroon 5, Faith No More, The Replacements, Three Doors Down, and OAR, while Will's credits include One Republic, OAR, U2, Michael Franti, and Spearhead, and others. Matt and Will set up their Dolby-certified mixing studio in the same complex as the legendary Sound City Studio in 2021 and haven't looked back. During our interview, Will and Matt talked about why analog recording experience is so valuable, the track that changed their perception of immersive audio, transitioning their studio to spatial mixing only, why rock is the hardest to mix in spatial audio, tag team mixing, and so much more. I spoke with Matt and Will via Zoom from their studio in Van Nuys, California. Let's just start at the beginning. I'd like to hear about your backgrounds, both your backgrounds, and how you got into the music business primarily. So, Will, let's start with you.
Oh, okay. All right. So I grew up in a tiny little farming community near Niagara Falls, Buffalo, New York. Didn't have really much of a guide as to, I fell in love with music when I was fairly young. Nobody in my family was a musician, other than at least my immediate family. I had a couple of cousins. One was a drummer, one was a bass player. Played in the high school band, did all that stuff. But I had no, you know, all anybody in my town knew about the music business was you could teach it or you could play in a symphony orchestra. And those are the only ways you could make a living. And just no attention. The idea, what are you going to go be a rock star? You know, that was the other option. That's insane. Who does that? So I got bitten by the bug and I kept going further and further down the rabbit hole. I tried to not do music my freshman year of college. I was a political science major. My sophomore year of college, I was like, I'm going to get music adjacent at least, but have a fallback plan. So I was a music education major. And then I dropped out of school. I was unhappy with all that because I wanted to work on great music with great people. I didn't want to teach kids who didn't necessarily want to be there, depending on the situation, how to do music. So I ended up eventually, after taking a couple of years off of school, I ended up at Berklee College of Music. I had no interest at that point or no understanding that I would end up in the recording, on the recording side of things. I discovered my passion for it while I was at Berklee. I was actually a trombone player. I was playing in big bands and jazz combos and stuff like that. But I was always into pop and rock music. That was always a passion of mine. And I kept doing things like I built a pickup for my trombone out of a practice mute so I could hook it up to a guitar amplifier and effects pedals and all that stuff. And eventually I made friends with a couple of the folks who were in the production and engineering course there. And I went, this is cool. I got to do this. And that's what I ended up pursuing. Graduated from Berklee in 1999. My first job in the recording business was soon after I graduated. I spent about 6 months working at Ocean Way Nashville. Nashville was not the place for me, and I ended up, for various reasons, decamping to New York, which is where I had originally wanted to go. After bouncing around for a couple of weeks, I landed at a great studio in New York called Right Track Recording. I was there for about a year or so, and then I got very ill, and I had no health benefits. I was making minimum wage. I was working 100 hours a week, as you do in big recording studios. Not a great way to try and get a handle on a chronic health issue. So I had to quit that job. I ended up moving back to Boston. I had worked part-time as an AV tech at Harvard University to put myself through Berklee. I ended up getting hired as the supervisor of that department at Harvard, spent the next 4.5 years at Harvard supervising the AV department for the undergraduate college. And then I was just about to turn 30 and I thought, I got to know whether or not I could have made it doing this recording thing. And my then girlfriend, now wife, said, you want to go to LA, don't you? I said, well, I don't know if want is the right word, but it's where they're making the records I want to work on. So I think that's where we got to go. So in 2005, moved to LA and again, bounced around a little bit once we moved out here. Eventually ended up doing some wiring work for a lovely man who became a great friend and mentor of mine named David Bianco. David kind of helped me get my feet on the ground in Los Angeles and eventually introduced me to Matt Wallace. And I started engineering for Matt in 2007. And we work pretty solidly together, you producing me engineering for what, probably like 4 years?
Yeah,
4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
And then, you know, went my own way, you know, budgets came down. Matt couldn't afford to hire as many people for his records. Lord knows I wasn't getting big budgets. But I went out on my own. Matt was doing his own thing, but we'd work on a couple of records together every year, you know, had become friends. And then in 2021, we partnered up in our immersive mixing studio doing Dolby Atmos mixes. And have been doing that solidly for the last 2.5, almost 3 years now.
Well, I want to get into that in a second, but let's go over to you, Matt, and give me your background. I know it's quite colorful.
Well, let's see. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of nooks and crannies to get into. I mean, basically, I lived overseas till I was 15. And so when I was 13, I was in, from 13 years onward, I was in bands with people, and I was a big fan of Deep Purple and Black Sabbath and stuff like that. And but also always had my ear to pop radio, so I was a big fan of the Carpenters and Neil Diamond and things like that. So I had this kind of wide swath of kind of musical influences, and probably similar to what Will did, you know, taking a mute and using it for a microphone for a trombone. In 1973, when I was 13, I had these two green G.I. Joe walkie-talkies and actually made a wireless guitar out of them. And this is before I think they were even invented or something. I'm not sure anyway, but I remember playing my friend Alan's bedroom, and it went out to his dad's stereo in the living room. So I mean, just stuff like that. And so moved to the States, and I guess because I was new in town, I just put ads in the school paper, you know, looking for musicians to play with and that kind of thing. So I did that for quite a while until eventually, while going to UC Berkeley, I built an 8-track studio in my parents' garage, ostensibly to make my own record. But once my friends who were musicians found out about it, I just started recording other people's music, which included this band called B-Team that got a Bammy. That was one of the first things I did, like in 82. And then basically the beginning, actually the rhythm section of what was called Sharp Young Men became Faith No Man, became Faith No More. And that rhythm section recorded in my parents' suburban garage. I had kind of an interesting following. People would come out from San Francisco and take BART all the way out to basically Lafayette and then my parents' garage. And I just worked there for a couple of years until I eventually moved out to Oakland. And once I graduated UC Berkeley, I was supposed to be an English teacher. And I was like, well, I'm already kind of making records. And I was already I was starving anyway. I mean, I was like so poor. And I just kind of kept doing it. And I just kept making records. And eventually graduated to, you know, 16-track and 24-track. But interestingly, I didn't have the usual experience where you know, you're a runner at a well-known studio, then you become an assistant, then you become an engineer. So and for better or for worse, I learned a lot of this stuff kind of on my own. There's a book called How to Become a Record Producer. I got that with a little flexi disc that showed like, here's a bass guitar by itself. Here's a guitar by itself. I did that, did one course in community college where I learned about some physics and things like that, but I just kind of blew things up. I ruined so much gear as I was learning. I built a 4x8 plate reverb, 4x8 feet plate reverb, and just built like flangers and stuff like that. Anyway, I just basically was a DIY kind of dude and just recorded a bunch of bands, and it ultimately got a gig at Slash Records in Los Angeles as a staff producer, A&R person, and then started doing records even outside of Slash, including like the Replacements and then Faith No More. Yeah, I thought I'd be here for 2 years, moved back to the Bay Area, and now it's been like 35 or 36 years I've been in Los Angeles. So yeah, and then Will and I met up. He was part of this team of engineers. We'd have like multiple people working in our studio here. And but we just kind of stay in touch. And then about 5 years ago, I was introduced to immersive audio Atmos stuff at the Dolby Theater through the Dolby folks. And I have to say, I wasn't that particularly thrilled about it. But then you fast forward a few years, Will and I have a friend, Brad Wood, who's a dear friend, also exceptionally talented producer, mixer, and Atmos guy. And he's like, you guys got to really get into this Atmos stuff. And we were both very, very reluctant. I didn't see anything that impressive with the technology, because in the Dolby Theater with 10,000 watts, sounded great. But when it went to this little Amazon playback, it just sounded really crappy and I wasn't impressed. And Brad's like, you got to check it out. And then Will and I were sitting there and Brad played us a Liz Phair track that neither of us had heard. And I think both of us were stunned at how much emotional resonance was included. Because I kept thinking about technology. Why this technology? What the hell? And I just remember going, I felt like I was going to cry. I was like, what the fuck? And we both afterwards, we talked, that was really emotional. He goes, yeah. And so, and he and I made a joke about this. I believe it's Will's fault that we built our Atmos studio. And he believes it was my idea. Neither one of us, we never sat down and said, we're doing this. We just kind of stumbled into it. But, you know, we built an Atmos room. We've got speakers suspended. And Will came up with all the calculations and his dad helped. And then we made this room. And then we had to learn how to mix. And that's a very short, condensed version of what happened. But the learning from stereo mixing to Atmos is a very, very big subject matter.
Yeah, I want to go there for a second. But you mentioned about the Liz Phair song that you heard that changed everything for you. Could it have been because it was something you were not familiar with in stereo?
That's a really good question. For me, I've had plenty of experiences hearing songs I've never heard before in stereo, plenty. And I know that feeling. And usually, yeah, you can have an emotional response. There's no doubt about it. There was something about being in the center of the music that nobody had told me about and where you just sit there and you quietly take it in. Part of it's active listening, probably. But it was just that you're much closer to the inception and the genesis of the music. You're kind of right there and the artist is right there and all the instruments that they try to create and you have to jam into stereo where you can barely hear because it's basically this big curtain of a bunch of sound kind of sandwiched together. Here everything's opened up and you can hear discrete vocals, discrete instruments. When Will and I remixed this replacement song called Aiken to Be, oh my God, you can hear how some of the background vocals are whispered. Some of the guys in the band were so tentative and they were so gentle singing. You got a couple of scrappy guys singing who always kind of took the center stage. But when you lean back, you go, oh my God, this guy's just kind of barely singing it. And you go, there's the heart and soul of the band. There's the charm. There's what's really important about this. And the Liz Phair thing, again, I think it was because we were so in the music and immersed. I hate to use that phrase, that word, but I just feel like we were in it and you could really get a sense of things. And we've actually had that happen with this Group Love song. There's a song called Cream by Group Love that is gutting. It just gets you. You know, it's not even a band that we were initially huge fans of. We like some of their singles, but when we play it to people we've never heard before, they say it. And when it comes down to his voice, he's so tentative and so gentle and you can feel his guts. And then when he sings it, then the band comes crashing in. It's stunning. It's just stunning. That's all I can say is it's,
yeah.
Yeah. Anyway,
I want to talk more about that in a second, but let's go back first. You started on A-Track. Did that influence the way that your career kind of expanded from there? The reason why I say is A-Track, you have to really make a lot of decisions in order to take all the mix elements and cram them onto those 8 tracks. Whereas today we don't have that. We don't have as many as you want. Did that influence your operation?
It influenced me a lot because I initially actually had a 4-track reel to reel. Then I got an 8-track. And the thing that you learn, and because there was no school, I didn't go to a 24-track school or a studio. With 8-track, you have to become... You have to have great instincts and you have to be fearless because you're going to combine stuff onto a track that you can never extract again. So when you're printing the drums, you're like, okay, they sound good now, but once the guitars and things are on there, I'm going to need a little bit of mid and maybe some high end. So you kind of and you're basically mixing as you go. Whereas with Pro Tools, all the people are doing is postponing decisions. You're recording everything minorally. And you have this, 250 tracks of stuff, and eventually someone's got to choose what to do with it. And invariably, someone's got like, I've got this DI guitar with a guitar plugin, but you can do whatever you want with it. It's like, no.
Yeah, right.
In the 8-track days, one side would have a kind of a low-fi, Les Paul. The other side, you could put a Fender, and then you knew where's the solo going to go? On top of the Les Paul, because it's already dark, and it's got this weight, and it's got some space up top for a sax or a guitar. And so when you're working in that regard, you have to kind of really think it through. Where does everything sit? And again, I used to track my drums on either one or two channels where I would run the snare drum into a bathroom with a snare on it with a mic and compression. So I had poor man's gated reverb. It was printed. It was all there. Like the whole thing is, it's there. and the rooms from I had a nice front room. I had all the rooms that were combined with the dry drums. And so when you push up the faders, like, it's mixed. What's next? So then it's really about balancing. And my first console only had one bus, so I could only either have add flanger to the mix or spring reverb to the mix. You know what I mean? That kind of thing. So, but I think it really means you have to have a band that knows what they're doing. They have to know how to play. You have to have a song. You know what you're doing with it. You have to have the arrangement together, because you're not going to be editing that stuff. You got to just get in there and you got to do it. And also, most young bands have very little money. I was charging $12 an hour for 8-track recording. That included a very large studio and me and my gear. And even then, for those bands, they're like, oh, we don't have very much money. I used to rent tape to them. Here's a half inch reel of tape. You can use it for this project, but when you're done, I'm going to erase it because the next band's going to use it, because they couldn't afford the $40 for the reel of tape. So it was all very, very, very low budge stuff. So, yeah.
Well, it's good to come up that way, because then you appreciate what you have now.
God, now it's easy. Making records now is easy compared to back then. You know, you really, and even the punching in and punching out in those days, you know, you would still hear these gaps, you know, especially with drums. So you were like, well, when I punch in the drums, you're going to stay to the end of the song because I can't get out. And so the musicians had to be able to play, and a lot of stuff was captured live for the most part, drums, bass, and guitar. Then we had overdub stuff. People had to know how to play. And it really reminds me of when we mixed some like Zeppelin stuff that we got to mess with, where you go, oh my God, these guys, or I mixed some Queen stuff. Tie Your Mother Down, drums, bass, guitar, vocal, live. And you can hear where they punch in the vocal, because all of a sudden the band goes away on the vocal mic.
Yeah, right.
And so it's like, well, yeah, back then, recording was a photograph, a snapshot. Here's a band, knows how to play a song. Here it is. We might do some overdubs. Whereas nowadays, you're basically in pointillism. You know, you're doing these like little, oh, we got to tune that. We got to put that in time. You know, this mono track, next mono track.
Yep.
Yeah. And also the interaction that's missing. Because in the olden days, people would be in the room, look at each other, and sometimes they'd kind of get going with something, and they'd go, keep rolling, and you do it. Now it's like, well, they already did the drums, bass, and guitar, so now we're going to do the keyboards, and let's see what we can come up with.
See, I think eventually it's going to go back to that, though, because music is getting so homogenized that it's now getting boring, because it's sounding the same. Productions are the same, because the only thing you can do is add or subtract tracks, because the track itself, the musicians aren't breathing with each other. So, you know, I'm hoping it's going to come back.
I've said, you know, if you were to walk onto a soundstage and tell all of the actors and the director and the camera people, you know what? We can do this all with green screens and camera phones now. So instead of paying for all this space and all this equipment and this real estate and everything else, we just want you all to go home, hear your lines, deliver them to the camera, do your best, and then we'll fix it all. We'll piece it all together later. They would say, you are out of your GD mind. There is no way we can give you what we give you when we're all here working together as a team to do this. But at some point along the line, and I'm not saying that everything that has been created in this kind of individualistic way is bad. It is a perfectly reasonable method of working under the right circumstances. But it's become the default nobody's putting any thought into whether or not this is the best way to do it, or if there's a more exciting way to deliver this particular project. It's just the most economic way to do it. So that's what we do. But we've taken away the essential communication of music by doing it, because playing to a click track as a common, you know, point of reference is not the same as even playing to a click track with fellow musicians in a room and having that immediate response to one another.
If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. You can find out all about my books, including The Mixing Engineer's Handbook, Recording Engineer's Handbook, AI for Music Production, The Music Business Advice Book, and more at bobbyosinski.com. There you can also read excerpts from all my books and learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news when you sign up for my newsletter. That's bobbyosinski.com. Tell me about your studio and how did you equip it? You decided that you're going to go Atmos, and it could be a very expensive way to go. But on the other hand, I've seen some really good setups that were reasonable in price.
Yeah. Well, yeah, absolutely. Because we know, you know, we know people who spent a tremendous amount of money on speakers and equipment. And fortunately, one of the ways that Will got me into this, because I had to bankroll the initial part of it, and I was like, oh man, how much is this going to cost? So Will had to really do quite a bit of research on the equipment, the, you know, the playback and all this stuff, but also the speakers. And there was a lot of options out there. A lot of it, I think, was pretty much overpriced. And Will had a couple of companies, but it really came down to this company called Cali.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And Will's like, man, I really think these speakers are good. He went and he checked it out at their space in Toluca Lake. And he goes, I think these are the speakers for us. And the good news is our initial buy for speakers was $7,000 for our seven surround speakers, four above and the subs.
Yeah.
So that was like, okay. Then I was like, okay, I guess we can try this. Because we basically, there was really a pretty a demarcation line between what we came from. And once we got into Atmos, we actually got rid of all the recording equipment in the studio. We are strictly Atmos and stereo mixing now. All the Neves and the 1176s and all, you know, the quad eights, everything gone. All the microphones gone, because all we do is mix. So that's kind of what we dove in feet first, and we had to learn how to do this stuff on the fly, because there's no elder statesman like, you know, Al Schmidt or Bill, you know, I don't think Bill Schnee ever did Atmos either, but
no.
But nobody that we can call up and go, hey, you know, we're trying to get this panning right and the deliverables. How do we do this? They'd be like, we don't know what you're talking about. So, and because to that end, Will and I, along with Brad Wood, and we was at Ken Sluter, Dave Way, and Todd Burke.
Oh, and Paul David Hager.
We basically put together this kind of loose group of like, we could call each other or write, hey, this assembler, does this not supposed to work? Or, you know, I mean, the renderer, how do you guys work with the renderer, you know? And so we basically formed a really lovely kind of community where we were simultaneously competitors, but also incredible support for each other. And the feeling that I had, this reminded me of back, say, 20 years ago, when if Will was in a studio at A&M and I was on another, we'd be bumping to each other in the hallway, like, hey, Will, check out this mix. You know, yeah. He'd be like, hey, can I borrow your guitar? Like, yeah, yeah. So now with this group, we get together once a month, either on Zoom or in person, and we get to just be communal and talk and, hey man, how the hell is it going? Or how do you get gigs? Or what do we do about these deliverables? So it's really, really been wonderful to be connected with a sense of community for me.
Yeah, it was the curse of being early adopters. There's a blessing and a curse to it, right? The blessing is you're the first ones through the door, and it's kind of the Wild West, which it honestly, it still is, but it's, we can see it from our perspective, we can see it being tamed already. But what we didn't have that everybody is so used to having now is there weren't a million resources available to us from a million different people saying, well, this is how you do this, and this is how you do that, and here's a manual for this thing, and here's how 100 people have been doing this particular thing for 60 years in this format.
Right.
There was nobody who'd done anything, and the technology had been changing so quickly up until the point we started that even the people who had been doing it, there were very, very few, like a handful, probably 5 to 10, who knew anything about mixing music for Atmos when we started. All of those people had been just trying to keep up with the pace of change, right? So, okay, here's how I deliver an Atmos mix today, but how do I do it next week? Well, all the software has changed, and they've changed a bunch of ways that this is going to work, and the delivery guidelines have changed. Okay, so here's a new thing, right? So before we can even get to the creative part, it's, okay, can we get this project across the finish line? And that's kind of why we all banded together early on. There are a lot more, even in almost 3 years since we started, there are a lot more resources available to folks now. So the learning curve is still incredibly steep, but the available information, both good and bad, unfortunately, but there is good information out there to be found.
Yeah. And also our group has expanded. We
yeah.
had 7 people. Now it's up to about 35, 40 people. And so it's just this, it's, you know, there's no leaders. It's just people get together. We talk, we figure things out. It's very amorphous.
Or a bunch of idiots on a text chain.
Yeah, basically. But again, really, really good. It's just, it's been pretty terrific, I have to say. And there were no books. There wasn't like,
yeah,
when I started on 8-track or with, you know, multi-track analog recording, there were tons of books I could read and at least, you know, intellectually understand what was happening until I actually got my hands on it. But this stuff, it's like, there are no books. There were no, like you said, there were no guardrails. There was nothing. And so we're like, how do we do this? So
yeah,
scary and exciting.
How have your mixes changed from when you started to what you do today?
So are you talking about mixes changed from stereo to Atmos or within the Atmos?
Within Atmos.
That's a good question. There's a couple of answers, and I'll get started, then we will kind of fill in the cracks. The main thing is that a lot of it was really learning how to pan things correctly, because where you put things would change how things sound in the headphones. So we really had to, we started kind of staying more static. Yeah, it used to be more static. We had like beds. We were working in beds. Everything kind of had a place. Then we kind of tiptoed out into objects. Okay, now we can move them between the beds. And we've expanded since then. But we've learned really how things translate to headphones is really a big thing. And also part of the challenge was that Apple's playback early on was not kind to a lot of the work that went into doing this stuff, especially stuff with saturated distorted guitars. It didn't play well with it at all. And the frustration was at the time was, or even with like Jason Mraz, who did Pop Stuff, we would send him these mixes. He'd be listening to the MP4, giving us judgment calls on the mixes on a playback system that was flawed. And we have to kind of go, well, some of these things we can do because it'll be okay. But some of these things, if we do it, it's going to sound okay in the headphones.
One kind of headphone. On one surface.
For 1 month, but then it's going to change.
But then, and then Apple might change it. And what you thought was what you wanted today might not be the thing that you want a month from now.
Yeah.
Because they're always driving both Dolby and Apple. So there's, long story short, there's three streaming services as of today in the US that do Atmos/spatial audio. And spatial audio for the moment is Atmos. That's the engine that drives it all. It's Apple Music is the biggest one, and then Tidal and Amazon Music. Tidal and Amazon use Dolby's binaural fold down for their headphone version of Atmos. Apple created their own, and therein lays the issue, which is we have to create a mix that works on speakers, which granted, most people today aren't going to hear it on it. Certainly they're not going to hear it on a system like in our studio. That's true of any stereo studios as well. Nobody ever hears it the way you hear it in the studio. But most people right now do not have Atmos playback at home. So the headphones are going to be their gateway into this world. But both Dolby and Apple have been very clear with us that they are tweaking the headphone algorithms constantly to drive the headphones closer to what it sounds like on the speaker system. So really, we should be treating the speakers as king and then tweaking for the headphones rather than making wholesale changes to accommodate the headphones and then have a mix that doesn't work well on the speakers. So this was all stuff we learned as we went along. And at the very beginning, we would do things like, in as Matt said, we were tentative, but before we were tentative, we went nuts. Because it's fun, right? You're like, I can throw this here and I can throw that there. And then you put the headphones on and you're like, oh, crap. This doesn't sound like anything anymore. And then have to start pulling apart, okay, what works? What doesn't work? What do we have to do to get these two things to bear some resemblance to one another? And that took a lot of work and understanding.
I have heard a lot of remixes of classic songs, classic albums that we all know and love, and I'm appalled sometimes at what's going on with them. That said, it seems like Atmos, and let's just say immersive music, seems to work better in some genres than others. Have you found that?
I don't know that it's necessarily a matter of better and worse. I think most of the problems come down to the mixes themselves. Certainly, I think rock as a genre may be the most difficult one to deal with. The drier things need to be, the more immediate they need to be, and the more distortion they have on them, the harder it is, at least in the binaural, on the binaural side, to make it make sense. It can make sense. You have to work awfully hard.
Yeah.
You have to put in the hard yards to figure out what you've got to do. You can make it sound blazing in the room, but blazing in the room is not always going to translate to good in the headphones. And I think that, at least for us, I'm only going to speak for what we feel about this. When we are working on classic songs, popular, huge songs that have generational, you know, appeal to folks. Our job, first and foremost, is to make sure that whoever hears, whatever fans hear the Atmos version that we've done, get the same feeling out of that that they got out of the version that they've been listening to for however long it's been, 30, 40, 50 years. That is first and foremost. There, nobody comes to us and says, put the Will and Matt stamp on this giant hit. It doesn't need us to be big. It's a great song and a great performance by a great artist that everybody loves. Our job is to take this thing that everybody loves, bring it to a new format, and allow a new era of listeners to enjoy it in the same way the previous era could.
Yeah, but it still has to say that the same vibe. Intrinsic feeling has to be there no matter what. And so that's the thing that we've worked on. We're always very cognizant of the people that created the music. And so when Will and I start working, we go, okay, what if the writer was here, the musicians, the producer, the mixer, what would they want us to do? And we don't have a thumbprint. We've done all kinds of stuff from pop to heavier stuff, but we don't have a thumbprint. We go, it has to feel like what they would do if they were here. And that's what we do for the most part. Now, we have had some more recent younger artists who say, do what you want to do. That's a thrill too, because then we can take what they've done and we can actually become much more creative with it. But like you say, the catalog stuff, we need to adhere to an aesthetic to the point that actually some of the stuff that was mixed during the cocaine 80s and 90s, which has got so much high end and so much compression. We even had that happen with a band, I'm not going to name, but we'll actually, because sometimes we tag team where one of us will start the mix, the other guy will come in and, you know, hand off. Will did this mix that sounded by far superior to the original thing that was on the radio. Beautiful, low end, punchy, gorgeous. And I walked into the lounge. I go, you're like, what do you think? I go, well, it sounds excellent, but it doesn't sound like the original. So then Will had to carve out all that beautiful low end, had to squeeze a bunch of high end on there, and invariably have to add distortion to some of this crap, because all that old stuff was printed so hot and distorted. And
they were herniating every piece of equipment in the mixing chain. The console, the tape machine, everything was distorting. Yeah. So that's what we had to do.
Yeah, so we have to learn to when we can kind of help out a little bit, just very judiciously add a little bit of low end. But again, if we do too much, people are going to go, that doesn't have that kind of bite to it that we're used to. It's like, yeah, you're right. We added too much low end. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think everybody, for the last few years, everybody seems to want to talk about the remixes of the catalog stuff, because it's what people know best. With new release stuff, that's kind of a different calculation. And obviously, it depends on the artist and the producer and the labels we're working with, but nobody's heard that stuff yet, right? There is no sort of public memory of what that music sounds like. So it tends to give us a little more freedom in terms of what we're able to do, even if people want us to adhere to, because most of the time the stereo mix is done first because it's the easier thing to do. Even if they say, we want this to sound pretty similar to the stereo mix, we've got a little more push and pull there, because we don't have millions of fans, you know, digging in, who have decades of memories of what this is all supposed to sound like. And sometimes we get folks that just say, doesn't matter, make it, as long as it sounds good, make it a great Atmos mix. And we're going to have that experience be a separate thing from what the stereo experience is. They're both out there. People can choose between the two and pick their favorite.
One of the best things I've heard is Revolver from the Beatles, obviously, in Atmos. And this was at a private EMI playback where Giles Martin was there to explain what was going on. And I have to say, it was great from the standpoint that it didn't feel like it was Atmos. It felt like just really good playback of the Beatles. And you didn't feel things flying around. It was very centered. And even though they use Peter Jackson's technology to extract all of the tracks and, you know, right down to a snare drum, you know, off of a mono track, it was pretty impressive. Now, every now and then they did pull something out that went around you, but for the most part, it was just very centered and really good, as opposed to many of the other mixes that I've heard that are, you know, a lot more adventuresome.
Atmos for Atmos's sake.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Right. And that is, I think that's something we both feel really strongly about, that this, the technology is amazing. And when you can spread stuff out all over the room and it serves an emotional purpose for the music, awesome.
Yeah.
If it doesn't, then don't do it. Just because you've got all the speakers doesn't mean they all have to be doing something all the time. If that's not, you have to take what the production and what the song give you.
Yeah.
Right. And sometimes that means you're doing something that's very, just sort of a slightly expanded stereo. Because that's what's correct in order to make it feel the way it's supposed to feel. We learned that lesson the hard way doing the B-52's Love Shack, where we thought, as anybody would, there's so much going on in that song, we can throw it all over the room. And that's exactly what we did. And then we flip back over to the stereo, and I think both of us were just like, what happened? Was it, Matt says, it's like it was like a bad souffle. It just collapsed in on itself. And it did not have any of the character that the original did. And then what we realized was, Don Was is a really good producer, and this is a really great band, and they very carefully crafted a stereo production. It's like a wall that they built, and we were reaching into the center of that wall, pulling a brick out, throwing it over here, grabbing another brick out of the center, throwing it over here until the whole thing collapsed, and we had to push everything back towards the front and then very carefully and judiciously say, okay, if we want to do something that's more, you know, expansive in space, what can we pull out of this sort of front wall that's built and place somewhere else without having the wall fall down? And I think we managed to do it, but it took 3 days of mixing to get there.
That, right. Yeah. Took a lot. And also it depends on the material too, because when was Love Shack was done? What year?
89.
Okay. So Love Shack was done in 89. I produced Faith No More's Epic in 88. That recording opens up to Atmos beautifully. Like, it was like we somehow imagined in the future what was going to happen, because we had just the right amount of recording and everything fit. We had four guitar tracks and it was great. And that lent itself to it. Whereas the B-52s is really more front centric, more stage centric, with some ancillary stuff around you that gives you a feeling. And back to this whole idea of Atmos, you know, Will and I can turn every song into a roller coaster ride. Yeah. Every single song, it will be amazing to listen to, but it doesn't mean it'll be good or appropriate.
Or correct, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So we always pay attention. You have to kind of decide what things are going to swirl around you, what they should stay kind of where they should be. And I think a lot of the stuff we do are things that we would imagine, like when we did Urgent by Foreigner, we thought if Thomas Dolby and the guys in the band were in here in the room, they would do the same that Will did. He did this swirling thing with that, you know, that signature keyboard part in the chorus. We did something, and everybody hears it, goes, oh, that sounds really cool. And it fits. It fits. Yeah. You know, we didn't do that with everything. We did it with that one keyboard, you know, so.
Yeah, and that tends to be, especially with catalog stuff, like none of this stuff was imagined in three dimensions. It was all imagined to be presented on two speakers. So if you're going to do more than that, you have to be really careful about how you take things apart. You're disassembling something and putting it together in a new way. And you have to be ready for the fact that your idea may not work. It may not be correct. And you may need to go back and reference what they did again and again and again before you find the right mixture and balance of what needs to stay the same and what can be different.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the advantages to Will and I working together. We're the only duo that I know that's doing Atmos as in tandem. And that is neither one, we don't both lose the plot simultaneously.
Right.
Usually one guy thinks he's doing great and the other guy is like, well, I see what you're trying to do, but... And so we have incredible checks and balances between the two of us. Will is very, very detail-oriented, and he can build a solid foundation and make it sound really, really good. And I come in there, but we take turns doing this. Yeah. But I'll come in there with elbows, and I'll kind of just like give it some juice and mix things poorly so that things kind of have some activity. And then he'll go, oh, I see what you're trying to do, and we'll dial it back, vice versa. Mm-hmm. You know. And so we have a really nice way of working together that is, I think, advantageous, just because we both have different personalities, different approaches to sound, and there's a sweet spot between the two of us that I believe is unbeatable. I think there's really something that's pretty incredible there. So
are you guys getting the multi-track sessions in, or are you getting stems?
Both. We get both. If it's anything that's catalog, generally it's multi-track sessions. Generally anything before what, 2009, 2010, and everything subsequent to that, we get stems, because people didn't know where stems were back in 1990. And
we're going to waste a reel of tape on them.
Yeah.
What would they do with a stem? Yeah. They wouldn't even know what to do with it. That's like half-ass mixing. So yeah, we do both. And it definitely takes more time. We charge more when we're working for multi-track because P52s, for an example, Will and I, with contemporary digital technology, recreated the feel and the sonics of stuff that was done, 30, 40 years prior with analog gear. And so we have to listen very intently and we have to recreate all these sounds so that it has this feeling. And I have to say, we're really getting good at something that was not natural early on.
Yeah. Yeah. And then even stuff like, and it's a fact that both of us, our careers both stretch back to the analog days. Mine started in the late 90s. So I saw sort of the end of the 24 track and 48 track analog era into the beginning of the digital era. But I'm aware of analog recording techniques. So one of the things we ran across with Love Shack was that they had once we figured out what was going on, at some point during mastering, somebody walked into the room and went, you know what? Just use a little energy on this. What do you think? And they very sped the tape, right? Happened all the time. We don't even think about that anymore. Nobody does that because we have a zillion other tools to make that happen for us. But here we are, like I'm having to squint really hard and go, why? Why would these tracks and this stereo master be 6 seconds different in length? It makes no sense. And then, and that's why we can't get the drums to sound right because they're at the slightly wrong pitch. Yeah. And that's why the bass doesn't sit. Yeah. And then the whole thing, like that we went through and we very sped the multi-tracks to match the very speed in the stereo master. And all of a sudden, they're everything that we've been fighting with EQ and compression and reverb to get for 2 days at that point. We're like, there it is.
Yeah. And also we have to sometimes find missing tracks or try to recreate them somehow. And so, because a lot of the stuff got lost in the interim of, 20, 30, 40 years. So yeah, we try to avoid that as much as possible. But sometimes we've had to recreate background vocal tracks by taking the lead vocalist and just running through Melodyne and recreating this thing that they had sung before, but it's gone from the tape, and the label can't find it. It's like, well, we got to put that in there because people are going to recognize that vocal part in the song. So that's what we do.
How about effects plugins? So what are you using?
Oh, wow. That's a Well, I'm a big fan of the Maserati VX1. I really love what that does to vocals. And I've used it on all kinds of things. And I think that's great. I think the Supercharger is a fantastic compressor. It's got...
That's one. Native instruments.
Yeah. It's got Dirt and Grit or something like that. Or Punch and Dirt. And I've used that on the stereo bus. I've used it on like a drum bus. And those are the things for me. And I'm probably unique in that I still use the original 7-band EQ made by...
It's Avid.
So that's
design.
That's the EQ I go to.
Me too.
And I go to the Bomb Factory 1176 because I just get in there and I just do it. And then I got some of these newer plugins that I happen to like. But Will's more versed in a lot of the.
I'm more of a tweaker when it comes to this stuff. But even I've limited my choices over the years just because for a 1.5% difference between one plugin that does the same thing as another plugin, I'm just like, you know what? I'm going to just focus on using the one. Because it gets the job done and I'll be able to move faster. In terms of Atmos plugins, we do use the big ones for us are the Liquid Sonics immersive reverbs. We've got all of them and we use all of them. Yeah. They're tremendous tools for making things work in the immersive space and in how they fold down, because that's hugely important. So on the binaural mix, everything sounds the way it's supposed to sound. In terms of the day-to-day stuff, I mean, we're both huge fans of the Sound Toys.
Oh,
pretty much their entire
Devil Lock.
Their whole line of stuff.
Yeah.
And I use UAD stuff quite a bit as well. Compressors, EQs. For me, their emulation of analog gear is. I will never say anything sounds like the real thing because nothing in everybody's version of the real thing is different. Try find me 2 1176s that sound the same. Just never going to happen. But in terms of when I use their stuff in a mix, it tends to do the thing I want the like as quickly as I can hope.
Yeah. I think that's an important thing about the Liquid Sonics reverb because it's something that it took me a while to get my head around. That is, when you're mixing in stereo, you're used to your stereo reverb. And when you put your stereo reverb in an Atmos system, it kind of stays in an area and it doesn't really spill behind you like natural acoustics would. And so Will found the same where, you hear the snare drum hit and it kind of goes around you. And it's just, it's a really wonderful, it's a theatrical thing, right? From movies.
Yeah, I think originally they built them all for post-production. And then when music mixing became more of a thing for immersive, they just expanded out and they work really beautifully.
Yeah, to me, those are the most important new tools. Like everything else, doesn't matter as much because they all kind of do compression, distortion, EQ, whatever.
Yeah.
But those reverbs were the game changer that now it sounded like this is Atmos. Now we're in Atmos.
But what do you do for mix bus compression?
Interesting about that. Everybody when we started, there wasn't an easy way to apply mix bus compression to Atmos. And everybody screamed bloody murder about it. And I thought I was going to be one of those people too. And then we actually started mixing. And it turned out that all the stuff people thought about what they needed bus compression or bus limiting for, you didn't need it nearly as much as you thought you did. And we all, and I'm not excluding myself from this, me included. Every time we would get to a certain point in a mix and I would go, well, you know what's missing? We don't have the stereo bus compression that they used on it. And we had ways of working around it using sidechains. It was a mess, but we could do it. It was just very complicated. And I would do it and I would listen to the mix and I would go, that's worse. And then I'd take it off. I go, okay, it's better. And then I'd switch over to the stereo one and I go, you can barely hear what they're doing on it with bus compression. And this has been true across genres. It's the amount we think we need it is nowhere near as much as we actually do. And it also turns out that dynamic range has a place in almost all music.
Yeah.
Because these days we're squashing everything to the degree that an acoustic guitar and vocal verse is exactly as loud as a full band chorus because of the amount of limiting we're using. There's no impact when the chorus comes in. And now there is. The verse is quieter and the chorus is louder. And boy, the effect that has on you is so far beyond anything you're going to get out of compression and limiting.
Okay. How about mastering then?
Well, that's an interesting
story. I'll jump on the mastering, but I want to go back to the bus compression. I actually, interestingly, I had a piece of gear that was my stereo bus compressor when I was doing stereo mixing. It actually stopped working and I actually unplugged it. So I have not done stereo bus compression while mixing in about 15 years. I just stopped using it. I used to be a really strong proponent. So what I would do is...
I'll vouch for that.
Yeah.
We used to, when we were tracking, we'd have massive amounts of stereo bus compression.
I love the sound of it.
Yeah.
But I stopped using that. So what I would do is I would do a lot of post-mix stuff. I would kind of do poor man's mastering. I would kind of jack it up so people could get used to it and kind of get the vibe. And so I would really save that to the end, which made me really mix very differently because the first thing I'd do when I used to mix, turn the SSL compressor on to start and then start mixing, which was ridiculous because then you're fighting it the whole damn time. So anyway, I learned that. So now back to mastering. So I'll make a long story short as possible. In the era of going from a magnetic tape medium to a physical cutting on a record, you needed someone who knew how to operate equipment that would take that energy and transfer it. And they needed specific equipment to do that. Now, once we got into digital, and budgets started going down. I used to hire mastering people, but then once the budgets started going down and the bands would be like, we don't have the $3,000 to $5,000 for the mastering. Can you do it? It's like, well, I can. I'm not great, but I can do it. So I've been mastering my stereo stuff for like the last 10 years because that's what people want me to do. Now, fast forward to Atmos. The things we learned in mixing in stereo required that you had to brutalize the sound. You had to either over EQ it or over compress it and overlimit it because you're trying to fit 20 instruments into two speakers. You had no other option. Now with Atmos, every sound has space. You can open it up, and because we have dynamic range again, which is great, and you don't have to do high pass filtering on all these instruments, it's there again. So you don't need to do it. And because we have very, very specific numbers to hit when we deliver to the labels, we thus far have not needed mastering. we're up for it. If the label wants to use Tube Mastering, they're welcome to do it. We don't have any control over it. The place where I think mastering in Atmos would be important is if you have multiple mixers on a project. I think to pull it all together, you would need somebody who can assemble it together. But generally, our numbers, Will is exceptionally articulated and specific. When we turn our stuff in, we get past quality control all the time because Will really pays attention to the details much more than I do. And so we have not had anything, as far as we know, nothing we've done has been mastered yet.
Yeah, it's we're at an interesting time with Atmos where most of the time right now, the stereo mix is being done first. So when we're doing the Atmos mix, and the Atmos mix has very strict guidelines about the length that it can be versus the stereo version. So we're actually being given the stereo masters, and then we're able to A/B against the stereo master while we're doing the Atmos mix. So really, we're using that as a guidepost in terms of what the vibe of our mix is going to be anyway. So we're applying all that EQ and trying to make sure that our thing sounds, you know, like it's in the same ballpark as that thing. Because that's where, at least for now, the artists and the stereo mixer and the producer put all their sweat, blood, and tears into that process. And we don't want to relitigate that. They're happy with those choices. We want those choices to remain the same unless they tell us otherwise. Because of the strict level standards for delivery, there's no making it louder. Nobody can make the mix any louder than it is when we deliver it. Nobody. Nobody's got any different tools than we have in order to do that. Nobody's got a different set of rules to follow. So that's off the table. And this only applies for right now. As of right now, there are a few, but there aren't a lot of mastering engineers. Like, one of the things we rely on in our mastering engineers is that they, in the space of time we may have mixed one album, they may have mastered 5 or 10, right? So they have this sort of 30,000 foot view of what's going on out there. And maybe, hey, you know, maybe you should have made this a little less low end across the whole thing, and we're going to match all this up and whatever. Well, we're already matching a stereo master, so we know what those right. choices were. Right. And right now, not saying forever, but today, there are very few mastering engineers who have more experience working in Atmos than we do. So I don't know who we're going to reach out to say, okay, you've worked on way more Atmos than us. You understand this landscape better than we do. But that could very well be a temporary thing. And as Atmos and immersive in general become a more widely accepted thing and a more widespread thing, we may slowly end up kind of coming back to more of the world that we recognize, where we're taking so long on the mixing side that we can lose perspective. Like, we're mixing from scratch. We don't have a stereo version that we're following on from. We're back at the beginning before the mastering process, and we need people again who have that set of skills to pull everything together for us. But it's not the world as it exists today. So we'd say we're mastering agnostic at this point. Like, sure. Yeah, if you feel like mastering can improve
sure.
what we've done,
absolutely.
By all means, go ahead and do it.
I think back to your point, the fact that we are basically matching an existing stereo master that has been compressed or yeah. limited or EQ'd, we're basically trying to match anyway. In fact, that's the only time we ever really use distortion or compression, is because we already have this pristine sonic qualities and we have yeah. all this dynamic range. It's like, oh, they did this thing and they like that sound, so we need to kind of retroactively stick that back in there so it sounds the way they want it. But again, it's already been done. We already have the roadmap. So if anyone would master, they'd be mastering a mastered yeah. thing anyway. You know what I'm saying? If that makes sense.
All right. So how can someone get in touch with you if they want your services?
Oh, that's a good question. We never did put together our website.
We've been so busy mixing, we haven't done a website.
Here's how you can get a hold of me. mcdman.com/Wallace. I think that's my manager's.
Yes.
Then they'll have all my information there, or just get a hold of him there too. You know, Frank McDonough, my manager.
To find out more about Matt and Will, go to mcdman.com/Wallace. That's mcdman.com/Wallace, W-A-L-L-A-C-E. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. You can also learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news when you sign up for my newsletter at bobbyosinski.com. There, you'll also find out about openings for my latest online classes and special events. That's bobbyosinski.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, where you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Apple Music, Mixcloud, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, TuneIn Radio, Radio Public, and Podbean. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.